Welcome back to another episode of Journey into the Vortex, where metaphysics meets real life. My name is Mary Roseman, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Marcella Nitschke and Heather Wells. We are three ordinary women who have seen our lives transform into the extraordinary through the discovery of metaphysical laws and principles. And that is exactly what we want to share with you each week, as we explore how expanding your consciousness through metaphysical awareness can bring clarity, purpose, and transformation into your life. So, let's begin. Hi there, and thank you for joining us today. We're continuing our Women Rising series with speakers that we've invited, and today we are interviewing Cindy Swall. And Cindy is a seasoned executive coach specializing in the needs of women in leadership. She's a highly requested speaker and known by her beloved tribe as the Bliss Mentor. Yet before all that, Cindy is a woman, a mom, a lover, body, mind, and soul, and all the things that come with that. That's important because she coaches from that place, the real world, kind of messy, super caffeinated, problem solving in the wild. These are Cindy's words. Humor, focused attention, and good old-fashioned accountability are the tools she will use to make good things happen in your life. An author, Cindy recently released her latest book entitled Bliss in the World, The Intentional Woman's Guide to Creating Everyday Joy. And we're particularly excited because as we advertise Journey into the Vortex as ordinary women experiencing extraordinary lives, this is going to be an incredible interview, and we really don't know where it's going to go. But I'm talking to a real down-to-earth beloved who's been in the executive world, but her presentation isn't that way. It's very earthy. That's what so intrigues us. And so thank you, Cindy, for coming. And it's particularly exciting to have you in Women Rising. I've participated in every year, but the last 2 years I've been helping facilitate and organize it. And so thank you.
It's been a fun evolution to actually watch that, because I've gone to it year after year as well, and just kind of watching it grow exponentially has been kind of fun.
Yeah. So we were talking before we started the recording about how you decided to, your background is in the corporate world, and from there to now coaching, you said targeting women, like just women or mainly women, or tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, not entirely, because a lot of my work is in the leadership world. Sadly, still a good percentage of people in leadership are not women. We're making some progress, but we're not entirely there yet, right? So, and don't get me wrong, like I really like men. I like working with men, and what I've noticed, like being in the, not even just in the corporate world, but just being in the world in general, is that the systems that are set up for people to be successful are just inherently masculine, right? They're very linear in nature. Everything from your onboarding processes to performance evaluations to even just setting SMART goals or whatever, like women don't operate that way. You know, we don't achieve goals by setting a goal. The goal in and of itself is not inspiring to us, which is why we have the same New Year's resolution like year after year, right? So it's really about, like, for us, it's not the what, it's the why. And so that's one of the things that I really did notice, is that when I was doing work just as an executive coach, a couple of things that I mentioned to you, first and foremost, is that I realized I was much less interested in just making people better leaders than I was in making my leaders happier people. Because I really did find that the leaders who, first of all, were very awake to the things that were important to them, to their own values, and they made decisions based on those. They had good work-life integration. They made time for the things that were truly important. They're happier, but they're just better leaders instinctively. And I also realized I liked working with women because it's somewhat safe for us to have that some level of vulnerability with each other, at least, right? To be able to put something on the table and say, I suck at this and I need some help. We can make that transformation happen pretty quickly. So that's really kind of what drove me into working more with women. Obviously, I am a woman. You know, I was a single mom. I built my business by myself. I renovated my house by myself. And it's been really interesting. So we get to that whole that Rima talked about that last year at the event, the whole like superwoman thing that we do. I was like, oh, yeah, that's me all over the place. But then you get to a certain phase in your life where you realize, yeah, I can do it by myself, but I don't have to. And so that's why I love seeing the three of you like in this nucleus, you know, creating this thing together, and how it's really amazing to see. So that's kind of what drove. So if you say, do I work mostly with women? I prefer to. Certainly my bliss camps are all for women at this juncture, but.
I was curious. So a lot of the metaphysical principles in your teachings, right? So is it easier? I would think women, we are a little more open to that. And well, to us, that's the main thing of any transformation. And obviously you believe that too. So is it easier to have women because they're more open also to these truths?
I would say 10 years ago, that was absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I will tell you now, it's not necessarily the case, because it's fairly mainstream to have conversations about things like manifestation and visualization and those kinds of things that being in the vortex kind of alludes to. So, and they're realizing it's not really new thought at all. Like this has been happening since the beginning of time, right? And so when we talk about like utilizing the principles, you're not really utilizing the principles. They're there whether you're utilizing them for good or for not so good, but you're always utilizing the principle. It's like gravity, right? So you've heard that. You don't get up in the morning and say, you know, I'd like to, you know, incorporate a little more manifestation in my life today. Like it's just how it is. And right, and we're just starting to become aware of how our thoughts and the things that we do are influencing that or creating that, co-creating that, if you will. So
I've noticed that I know even like the CEO of my company and other leaders, they really do now openly talk about their morning, their practices of meditation, that they know that they have to, men or women, that they seem to incorporate this balance of life and their intentions. And it just seems-
and it's not just about being a kinder, gentler leader, right? It's about like men can now, it's tactical. So they can like measure that to return on their investment, right? And so that's what they were looking for. They're like, I'm looking for a number that if I do this meditation in the morning, I'm going to make more money, or I'm going to bring more clients in, or whatever it is, right? Whereas women tend to go, you know, how is that going to feel for me? And it's not because, and don't get me wrong, I deal with some business women that I have over time too that aren't particularly, they've kind of closed off that side of themselves because they've had to survive in that kind of an environment. But I even see this, what's really interesting to me is more cultural creatives, right? So I work with a lot of people who, because I have the Unity background and the metaphysical background in my upbringing, I tend to kind of attract people who are kind of in that environment. So I work a lot with like writers and, you know, authors and right. actors and massage therapists and spiritual leaders, you know, and people who are, but who are really, really good at the spiritual components and the work that they do, but they're trying to figure out how to monetize it. Right. So I can't tell you how many people that I talk to on a daily basis. They're like, I'm real clear on who I am in the vortex. And I got to figure out how to make a living doing that. Right. And so there's a lot of that. So I'm seeing the ebb and flow kind of go. It's like either dealing with Fortune 100 companies or people who are just trying to figure out how can I create more life satisfaction or fulfillment in my work.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
So I'm interested in the very beginning of this. Okay. So there you are. First of all, what made you choose to, with who you are, how you were raised, what you were seeking, and then you went into the executive world. And I could be projecting because some of my experiences were different, right? Yeah, and I don't want to project a hostile environment, but I found it very, I didn't last in it. I didn't like the backbiting and the competitiveness. Now, was that just my state of mind and what I was attracting around me? Or did you ever experience that? And how? And when you did you set a goal to transition this or transcend this? Or
Yeah, I'd love to tell you it was that intentional. But I would honestly, what happened, I'm not sure when you moved into the workforce, but when I came out of college and I moved into the workforce was like the mid 80s. And at that period of time, women were competing for everything. We were competing for partners. We were competing for jobs. We were pitted against each other because it wasn't that long. I think I saw a meme not too long ago that said it was like 1984 or something like that. And when women could actually sign for a credit card without a cosign, you know what I mean? It's like, that's been in our lifetime, which is insane to think about. Right. So I think early in my career, it was more cutthroat just mm-hmm. because opportunities for women were really minimal. Like when I went to college, you were either a nurse or a teacher or you're a psychologist or, you know what I mean? There were specific things that were carved out. Whereas it doesn't look like that anymore. So I would say I see much, much, much less of that now than I did, you know, in the early years of my career. But I'm not going to say like in a big, and I'm not anti-corporate, don't get me wrong. It was so funny because when I took the voluntary separation, when I worked for Sprint and I left there in 2008, and I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to work in corporate because it just doesn't nurture the soul, right? So that's what I decided. But then I started realizing that the people who were coming to me for help were actually in the corporate arena. It's like one of the things that you said when we were just kind of talking offline was how, what was your tagline about ordinary women doing extraordinary things? Like all of us are the same. Like, I don't care if you are a hairdresser or if you're a CEO of a Fortune 100 company. What I find is that women have the same stuff, right? The same fears, the same insecurities, the same need for connection, the same, what do they call it? The, you know, imposter syndrome or whatever, you know what I mean? And so it's interesting. Like I can take a woman from a homeless shelter, and I do a lot of work with the Women's Employment Network. I was on the board for them for a while, and then work with someone who's a very accomplished senior leader in a major organization. And when you sit down and have like real conversations about real things, you realize that there's really not that much of a difference. You know what I mean? There's just not. Mm-hmm. And so once we can start talking to each other as people, a lot of that transition happened during the pandemic when people are like, screw it, I'm just going to tell you how I feel. Like, if we're all going to die anyway, like, let's just do this. I mean, it was just really interesting
how
people just get like all honest and vulnerable when there's so much at stake. So as far as the transition and how I got here, I mentioned I with you earlier, I actually managed banks for years, which was insane because I have like almost zero left brain activity. So I don't know how, I think that's why I managed instead of actually counting things. But that was something I did for a while. And I'll tell you how I made the transition. It's actually kind of funny, and I'll try to abbreviate the story. But I was managing a bank at 44th and Main. If you're in the Kansas City area, it's like in the Plaza area. Mm-hmm. So I was managing a bank there. And so I would walk down to the Plaza at lunch. So here I am in my navy blue suit with my little tie and my little heels walking down on the Plaza. And they were building something into this square. Anyway, it kind of an underground area. Looked like they was building a restaurant or some kind of a store, but I couldn't tell what it was. But there was this giant, like a conveyor belt that was as wide as a room. It was huge. And this, like, I'm like, what are they doing down there? And so I literally walked into this construction site and opened the door. I was like, what is this thing? And it was a ski, it was a place called Sun and Ski. And it was actually a artificial ski simulator. I don't know if you remember that. It was called Sun and Ski down the Plaza. Mm-hmm. And they literally, like, you get on your skis and you go down and the carpet's going up. So you never get to the bottom. So if you fall down, it just takes you back to the top. And it was the cool. I was so fascinated by this whole thing. And their general manager was there. It was a woman at the time. And we were having this conversation. She goes, you should come and manage the store. I'm like, I've literally never skied or worked retail in my life. She goes, yeah, but I like you and I like your energy around. I think you should come to work for me. And I was like, okay.
Why not?
So I went back and I quit my job and I went to work for this ski shop. And I worked there for 2 years. It was really fun. It was still not my jam, but it was like, it was such a dramatic shift in what I was doing that it opened up a side of my of possibilities for me that I didn't even know existed. And so then I was able to really start playing with kind of the training and development side, because I was training a lot of people. And so I found the training and development pieces were a little more to my liking. So just a lot of study around the psychology of human behavior. And then how I kind of got to where I am now is when I was at Sprint, I was working with a gentleman Dr. Marty Seligman. You might be familiar with him. He wrote like Authentic Happiness and Dr. Andrew Chate, who does a lot of work around resilience. And so when I was working with them, they kind of introduced me to the concept of positive psychology. Because, you know, they studied people with depression and mental illness for years, right, to try to figure out how to help them. And my mother was bipolar as I was growing up. Well, she still is, but now they know what it is and they know how to treat it. But but at the time, they were trying to figure out how the statistics weren't getting any better. So they decided, well, what if we studied happy people? There's a concept, right? And really started looking at people who had a healthy adjustment and started, that's when they started doing a lot of the resilience work. And when I started getting involved in that, I was like, heck yeah. It's like, we're not going to ignore that these things don't exist, right? There are chemical reasons sometimes why people go through depression and other things. But a lot of what we're dealing with now has to do with just the point that you have, which is like, where are you focusing your energy in your
life? Yeah.
That's why your work is so important.
Yeah. Thank you. We are mesmerized by you.
I'm even fascinated to the point that the opportunity, you were walking down the street, the universe opened up a door for
right,
you and you took it and it.
Well, there's a chapter on synchronicity.
It
depends on what you wish for, right? Because when you have your intention, then the environment will push you away from if you don't resonate with it anymore, your intention is elsewhere, or even the people in your life, right?
Or you know what's really hard is that a lot of times people have to wait for that. I think Edwin Gaines calls it the cosmic 2x4, right? So some people are like stay in a crappy job or a job that they're
right
for, or a marriage or a friendship or anything that they've that's not a good fit for them. But they do it because as women, we've been taught that people are not disposable. Right. And then we're supposed to like stay in it no matter what. And we're supposed to make this work. And at some point, it's like if in fact you are continuing to grow and evolve, which you are, if you're still in a skin suit, you're continuing to grow and evolve, then, you know, there's, you know, when you first meet somebody, you're kind of vibrating at the same place. Right. So you're both kind of doing this. But then as you start to develop yourself, right, as you set a stronger intention or a better intention for your life and you take actions towards that, the wheels are going to fall right off the bus of your current reality, right? So now you're here and they're here and you're going to do this. So they have a choice to make, right? They can either look, can look at you and go, I'll have what she's having, like come up with you, or they don't, right? And at which point, and here's where I run into problems. I see this at the Women's Employment Network every once in a while, where these women come in because they've got a bigger vision for their lives, but they have other people in their life who are holding them down. Mm-hmm. But now they've educated themselves and they know what they're capable of. And they see a different vision for what's possible for them. And so now they go back and in order to try to retain this person in their life, they try to come back down, but you can't, right? Brain once expanded can't regain its original shape. Like you can't go back and pretend like you don't know this anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where they get into trouble, I think, is just like, you know, once you start this process, it, you know, some people don't get to go with you. It's hard.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So the part that's fascinating me is, so things weren't always rosy for you. And yet you were able to stay in this positive mode that you are. You were able to see the possibilities, right?
And well, I think it's important to know that not every day, like some days I didn't, right?
Uh-huh.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you. Were you not finished with your thought?
Well, I don't want to, having a bipolar mother would make your life complicated. And I don't want, like, is that a projection? So the part of me, the social work, the, you know, the psychological dynamic, I want to know, I would study you. You know, you were saying, I want to study happy people. You fascinate me because you made this work and you not only made it work, but you're helping a lot of other beloveds. Do you see where I'm coming through this? So
yeah, I do. And when you're a child, let me just say, first of all, when you're a child, it's your normal. Like what my mom was going through, what she was going through, but it was like, it was always like, well, you know, your mom is sick. Like that was just like, was that, that was our normal. Like we thought everybody's mom did that, right? And so we didn't know any better, right? And so I remember walking into the living room when I was about 6 years old and my mom was watching TV. That's what she looked like she was doing. And I asked her if she would come outside and play with me. And if you know anything about mental illness, she just couldn't do it.
Right. Like
she didn't have it in her to right. do it. Right. And it wasn't her fault, but she just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But I remember like walking out the door and I wasn't angry or anything, but I remember closing the door and walking outside and thinking to myself, when I grow up, I'm not going to be sick. Like I'm going to play with my kids and I'm going to take care of my stuff. And then when I thought about that, I was like, holy crap, that's what happened. Like the pendulum swung way over here first. Right. So not only am I really good at taking care of my stuff, I'll take care of all your stuff too, whether you want me to or not. Right. And so it made me realize that I was drawing people into my life who needed to be taken care of. I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but that was a pattern for a while too. And so a lot of it is just, and I really do believe that my foundation in Unity as a child, like in YOU and others, was really helpful because it's like a lot of things were instilled in me before I had enough cognitive wherewithal to argue with it. You know what I mean? So I was just like, oh, well, that must be true. I did have that kind of this interesting like dichotomy going on all the time between the whole life is really hard and yeah, but it'll be okay. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there was like this thing going on all the time. So yeah, you know, it's what I've found myself doing is like during the pandemic, right? When the pandemic happened, I make a living by connecting people, by bringing people together.
Right.
You couldn't do that. And I'm my only source of income, right? There was not another income coming in. And so at the time, I remember within a week and a half, I lost 100% of my clients.
Wow.
100% of them.
Wow.
All of my income in a week and a half. And so I have to tell you, like the first couple of hours, I did sit in the embryo position in my bathroom for just a little bit, right? And then I was just like, wait, not productive. This is not productive. So what can I do? So the first thing I do is I gave myself permission to just feel like crap for a couple of days. And then I was like, okay. And so once you get through that, then you better get a plan, right? And so and I didn't know what that plan was going to be. I think honestly, the biggest thing, Mary, is that the ability to understand, like, you know, I don't need to know how I'm going to fix it. I just need to know it's possible.
Okay.
And that has been, hope. That was my, but it's even more than hope. It starts with hope and then it's
certainty beyond.
It's knowing. It's just a knowing that's like, I've been here before and I'm going to land on my feet. And so Doug Krug, who wrote The Enlightened Leaders, I remember having an interview with him one time when I was doing the Enlightened Leader series for Unity. And one of the things that he said is when he was talking about that is he said, you know, there's a distinct difference between believing and knowing.
Yes.
Right. Everybody believes something. Right. But do you know for sure? I think Byron Katie says that. But do you know for sure? That's like part of her process. Are you sure mm-hmm. about that? Right. Like, can you prove it if you were in a court of law? Right. And if you can't, then you just don't know for sure. But I had enough data to support that. This can fall apart and I can rebuild it, right? And so that's where self-efficacy comes from. It's not because I'm more skilled or talented than anybody else. It's just I believe it's possible. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I know it's going to happen.
Thank
and
you.
That really is the, right. the crux of the whole thing, is just trying to figure, like, we all have ebbs and flows, but staying still continuing, and maybe it does start as hope for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to go, you know, I have enough hope in this, which turns into faith, which turns into belief, which turns into knowing. You know, it's an evolution.
Yeah. And so when you're coaching a beloved who doesn't embrace all the principles that you're speaking of, yeah, what's your process?
Well, I will tell you that most people that I work with, this is somewhat foreign to them. And so I spend my first couple of coaching sessions in what I call discovery. And so I won't coach anybody for less than 6 sessions, because the first couple of them really are just discovery, and not just us getting to know each other, but more importantly, them getting a clear understanding of what it is they really want. Because a lot of times people will come to me with an issue or a problem they want to solve, and that's not really the problem at all. It's like a symptom of the problem. So as we start dissecting it, we're like, okay, I think I know where this is coming from, right? And so And so a lot of times it depends, right? I don't do a lot of one-on-one executive coaching anymore. I do as parts of like a program, like a high potential program. But to be honest, it's not a scalable business model. I much prefer the group work, but when I'm working with a client who doesn't understand the principles, all you have to do is change the language, because the concepts are the same. And you can talk to somebody about going through a guided visualization, or you can say, you know what, I'm going to help you picture some things to see if we can kind of, you know, let's just do some reflection to see if you can kind of remember what that looked like. So a lot of it just has to do with the languaging. So I can go into a senior executive session and sit at the board table and get some of these people to do these things, as long as I don't call them something, like I can't call it a meditation, or I can't call it a guided visualization, but I can say, hey, let's see if we can reflect on this a little bit. You know, it's going to be important for us, for setting the foundation of this conversation, to know kind of where this is coming from. Let's take a look at it, right? And so I think for a lot of people, it just has to do with, it's really semantics, because mm-hmm. you're still doing the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So we've been really, really serious. Now let's turn it to joy.
Okay.
So now it's like, now we're like on our fourth or fifth session. And you know all the, you're well aware of what this beloved wants. They want to achieve it. You're aware of what eluded them for so long that they weren't in touch with. So what do you bring to the table in the introducing somebody who really, I'm not saying they're joyless, they're just not conscious of how to create joy?
Well, I will tell you, the first handicap, honestly, is that most people don't even know what brings them joy.
Right.
And they don't. Mm-hmm. They know how their husband takes their coffee. They know, you know, what their kids' favorite shoes are that blink up or whatever. But I mean, it's like so many women can't even articulate what brings them joy. So that's usually where I start. As I start, I say, okay, you've got 4 days or 3 days or whatever, and I want you to make a list of 100 things that bring you joy, and you cannot stop till you get to 100. And usually women will get to about 20 or 25, and then they're like, yeah, I can't think of anything else. So it's like, no, use all of your senses. You know, maybe it's a pumpkin candle, or maybe it's that yellow house on the corner that has Victorian, you know, architecture. I really love that yellow house. Or I like a soy 2-pump vanilla latte with extra foam. Or I just like it when my son puts his back against the fire and then comes and sits on my lap and gets me warm, right? Like, I want you to think about it. I don't want to say my dog and my car and my kids, like, duh. I want to know, like,
the big things, like the big, yeah, the vacation in Mexico, or, you know, something.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course that's going to bring you joy. It's like, but I think for me, like, the crux of my work, honestly, is just around helping people recognize the beauty and the joy in the day to day. That's what bliss in the wild is. It's about, like, through whatever hell or monotony you happen to be going through at the time, there's something to be seen. Like, I drove my daughter to the airport this morning at like 4 o'clock in the morning. She lives in Maine, and so she's going back home. And so I took her to the airport, and I'm coming back home, and I'm still like half awake. And I get out of my car, but you know that time in the morning where no one is out there yet?
Right.
And it's so crisp and so quiet, and the birds were just starting to sing, and I could hear the wind blowing, so the trees were rustling. It's like you never stop and go, oh, wow, that is so beautiful. You know, just little things like that, to be able to say, you know, I love it. You know, I like putting fresh linens on my bed. Like, I put fresh cotton sheets on my bed every time I go out of town, so that when I come back home, I come home to clean fresh cotton sheets. That brings me so much joy, you know. But I do think that, first of all, it's just getting a really clear idea, number one, of what are the things that bring you joy, or used to bring you joy, that you don't do anymore, or don't make time for anymore. And then secondly, how do you incorporate those things into your day to day?
Would you say that, I was looking at the list that you have in your book, and it's, and I love it when you say the world cannot bring you joy, and the world out there cannot take it away. So it's more like a subject. It's how you assign joy to something, right? It's an internal process that you, so it's a choice.
100%. When you look at the story of Nelson Mandela, right? It's like a prisoner of war. You know, and he, one of the things he said, you know, and it's once he was finally kind of moved back into civilization, and he said, you know, they're like, how did you survive that level of you know, just inhumanity. And he's like, you know, what I finally realized is like, you can take everything from me. You can take my food, you can take my clothes, you can take my shelter, but you cannot tell me what to think. Right. And he said, that was my only salvation, like knowing no matter what, just continuing to visualize myself walking out of that gate. Right. And so, so that's a pretty extreme example. Like most of us will never be in a situation like that, but just recognizing like on a day-to-day basis, like, what am I paying attention to? You know, it's little kind of what would seem like insignificant things. This winter I was pulling up, you know, almost every street corner now, when you pull up to the light, there's somebody there that's, you know, panhandling or whatever. And there was a fairly elderly woman there. I want to say she's probably in her 70s, maybe 80s. And she had on a sweater, but she didn't have anything on her hands. And it was freezing cold outside. And she was sitting on a bucket. And there was a kid in a Jeep in front of me. He was maybe a teenager, maybe young, maybe early 20s, I don't know. And so I was parked behind him, and I saw him kind of motion to her, and I thought he was going to give her some money. And then he hands her something. I couldn't tell what it was, but he went to drive away. She had earmuffs. He took his earmuffs off of his head. Aww. And because he had an open Jeep, and he handed this woman his earmuffs. Mm-hmm. It's like, these are the kind of things that happen around you all the time, all the time. And I was just like, wow, that is just crazy. And I tell some of those stories in my book, but it's like that, those kind of things, when you start paying attention, when you're actually seeking out reasons to feel good, and there's, trust me, if you're on social media, right, you can find all kinds of reasons to really be terrified about living on the planet right now. Right. But so one of two things is going to happen, right, with this age of Aquarius. Right? I was talking to my daughter about this actually when we're driving to the airport. She was like, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I said, yeah, probably. She said, but you know what, Mom? I believe it's going to get better. She was like, but my daughter's generation is going to make it better.
Right.
I mean, they are. Like this, the last couple of generations that have been born onto the planet are here to save us from ourselves. Mm-hmm. For sure. I do truly, truly believe that. But anyway, so that's kind of what it's about. It's like joy isn't just about, you know, riding the carousel or eating ice cream or having a balloon. I mean, those are all great. But joy is just really just recognizing what's going on around you, where there's goodness, because there's every opportunity. And in fact, it's marketing. We have been marketed disaster. Brene Brown says we actually dress rehearse tragedy, right? It's like, so we assume worst case scenario so that we're not disappointed. And that's like messed up. I'm sorry, but we do that, don't we?
Yeah. I remember when she first said that, when I first saw it, and I totally identified with that from the very beginning as a child. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just catastrophized. But, and we make stuff up in our head, like barring all the information, we just make up stories about what we think is actually happening. And then we just like beat ourselves with it for a while.
And then add a little ingredient here.
Mm-hmm.
There. Yes.
Yeah. I was working with a client a few years ago, and there's where they were doing a big layoff. The company that he was working for, and he wasn't even slated for the layoff. It wasn't even his department, but he was like so freaked out about it, right? Because he told me, Cindy is like, we just built this house, built a huge house. He goes, my wife loves this house. And he said, if I lose my job, we're going to lose the house. And I'm not kidding you. If I lose this house, my wife is going to divorce me. And if my wife divorces me, I'm never going to see my kids. Like, and he's literally going down this like spiral. Next thing you know, this guy's like living in a dumpster behind Walmart. We're like, okay, time out, right? But that's what we do, and it usually happens at like 3 o'clock in the morning, right? And so, when I hear stuff like that, and you're just like, oh, okay, so what's most likely to happen? Because let's go there for just a minute. But most of the trajectories we go down that are really unhealthy aren't even about. It's not even about being optimistic. It's just about being accurate.
Right.
So I don't know. We can seek out evidence to support whatever we believe. That's just who we are.
Yes. But,
so I guess at the core, you need to know what makes you happy, and that's where you start.
Mm-hmm. So give me just kind of a brief description of your bliss camps.
Oh, well, I'm not sure there's a brief description of a bliss camp, but because they're all kind of a thumbprint.
Right.
It's really funny because when I first started doing Bliss Camp, or what I called Bliss Camp, it was really like a one day kind of training in a pretty place, because, you know, I have a training background, right? So to me, it was very tactical, and I mean, it was personal, but it was tactical, and it was just one day. And then I realized, like, you know what would be cool is if we could just spend the night. And so we'd have the evening to kind of gestate on this and spend some time together and do something social and give it. So I started doing one night, and then we very quickly realized that one night was not nearly enough, because everybody's like, I'm just getting to know everybody, and then we have to leave. So I started doing two nights, and now I do a minimum of three nights, because what I find is that first night when people show up, they're all playing nice, right? They don't know each other. Mm-hmm. A lot of them don't know each other. And you're standing around like holding a kombucha or a cocktail or whatever, and just kind of having conversation. And then we do our introductions and that sort of thing. But by the end of that second day, when they've actually had some like more transformational conversations, or maybe we've done some things that have kind of opened up some things, either some chakra work, or Jenny Hahn has come in and done process painting with us, or we do contemplative photography, or we do booty yoga or whatever. And so we're starting to kind of open up and realizing that we're not alone, right? So by the end of that second night, they're really getting to know each other. By the end of this third evening that we're there, these women are like laying all over each other, right? Because they're just so connected,
right?
So many ways. And it's so funny, because like the last one, Rima and I did one a few weeks ago, and it was for women in leadership. So it was all female entrepreneurs. And we had women who were like, anointing priestesses. And we had a woman who's like runs a database marketing company. And, you know, there's a woman who runs the Heart Cardiovascular Center at Advent Health. I mean, so there's like such a vast array. We had a gal in from DC who does a lot of tech work, but we had very disparate types of businesses. But realizing that as women in business, we're all running into the same really similar things, mostly in our own limiting beliefs. So it's pretty cool. So like I said, it's always a thumbprint, and it's very much driven by the location. Like we did one in Oregon last fall. And, you know, when you're in Oregon, you have to do the Silver Falls Park. So you walk behind the waterfalls, and we stayed at little vintage campers, and went to Willamette Valley Vineyards, and it was just really spectacular. But it just depends on where we are and what we're doing. Round Top, Texas, we all went down early and we did junking, you know, that was really fun, by the way. We went to a honky tonk bar and celebrated everybody's birthdays. And then in between all those things, we did really powerful, meaningful work together. And so it's just to me, Bliss Camp, it's not a heavy camp. Not to say that we don't cry a little. We laugh, we cry, we do all the things. But it's not heavy. I don't want anybody leaving there, because I'm not a therapist, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a Bliss mentor. So my job is to figure out like some things are going to come out of those conversations that we maybe haven't touched in a while. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that could be really sensitive, and that happens pretty much on the regular, but I don't want anybody leaving there with an open wound. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, if it comes up, let's handle it as it comes up. And how can we make sure that we're leaving there with some tools to move through it? So, you know, maybe not move through it over the weekend, but by the time they leave there, they're feeling really good about where they are and how they can, you know, and having the resources they need to be successful. And quite frankly, having a new consortium of women who have been there with them and keep them on this journey. It's really cool to watch, you know, how they still support one another after the fact.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm curious, what's the number like 20? What's the number of?
A lot of it's driven by the venue. I would say the smallest camp I've had has been 9 with, and then me and my assistant, so 11. The largest camp I have has been 28. So I like to keep around the 20 mark. Somewhere between 18 and 22 seems to be like the optimal number, because it's still, you know, a small enough group that we can travel together if we want to go somewhere, but it's, you know, it's big enough, you can get some really meaningful conversation. There's more activities that you can do, you know, to kind of get to blend a little bit. So.
And when are you having the next one? You just have one in March, right?
Had one in March. I've got another one coming up September 19th through 22nd. It's in New England. So this one's in Franklin, New Hampshire. So you'd fly into probably Manchester, or you can fly into Portland or Boston. You know, everything up there is like right next to each other.
Year to see that part of the country too, right?
Yeah, it's spectacular. Yeah. So what's really cool about it, side note, is that I'm having Bliss Camp that weekend, and then I'm just going to stay and fly my fiancé up, and we're just going to get married up there. So you got to come to this Bliss Camp, because it just is going to be unlike any other, that's for sure. So I have a lot of friends who are, you know, people who are coming in for a Bliss Camp, and then they'll just stay the next weekend, bring their partner in and stay the next weekend and stay for the wedding. So if anybody comes up for Bliss Camp, of course, they're welcome to the wedding. But
that sounds fun.
I know. But Bliss Camp is my first love, for sure. If I could do that every weekend, that's what I would do.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
And just a reminder, dear listeners, you can find everything on Facebook for Women Rising at Unity Village, April 20th.
And what's your website? Is it?
It is just cindyswall.com. And the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So it's just called Bliss in the Wild. If you want to check it, it's kind of a self-coaching workbook. So I don't know if you noticed that. It's like you can like write in your answers and... So,
yeah, it's a really cool book.
Love it.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll put that on the episode notes to have the links to your book.
Okay.
And we're going to do our closing right now and join us. Well, actually, we'll have another interview real soon for you.
On our next journey into the vortex.
Thank you. We hope you have enjoyed today's dialogue. Please do not hesitate to let us know if you have questions, suggestions, or simply want to connect. You can reach us through our website at journeyintothevortex.com, Facebook, or Instagram. We hope you will join us again as we continue this transformative journey into the vortex.